Welcome to 503. My name is Dave. I'm going to be here with you all week. I know that I was talking to at least one person who said, oh man, Mike Poor's not here anymore. Yes, Mike Poor taught this class for a lot of years. Mike Poor retired not too long ago. And I've taken the class back over from Mike. The good news is, I'm the guy who taught Mike before Mike started teaching for Sen. So I have some idea of what I'm talking about. My name is Dave, Dave Holzer. I will give out business cards at some point, so if you want my email address, you'll have that. And I will encourage you that if you have questions or thoughts or problems, not just this week, but in the weeks or months to come, related to computer security issues, you're welcome to contact me, okay? I'm not here for marriage counseling or anything else, but if it's information security stuff, knock yourself out. I am happy to help. That could be, what's this weird packet? I've never seen it before. It could be, we've got this attack going on. Could you look at these packets and give us some input? We're trying to design a thing. What should we do? Help yourself. If you do choose to write an email to me, I will just warn you now that you want to put the word SANS in the subject line of that. Because if I do not recognize your name when I get that email, guess where you're going? That's right. You're going into the spam folder. I'm sorry. But if you put SANS in there, now don't tell all the spam and fishers out there, but if you put SANS in there, I've got a rule that'll suck you back out and put you in my inbox, okay? Just give me a couple days to get back to you. The 503 class, in my opinion, is one of the very best classes that we've got. It is a deep technical class, but it's not a class where we're just trying to teach you facts. There's a lot more to it than that. In order to lay out kind of what we're doing for the whole week, and I'm trying something new this week, so you'll notice I'm wandering around with this tablet here. So we're going to see how well this works in the first day. If it doesn't work well, it's going to go away. The reason for it is because we're also recording this class for the on-demand folks. And for the on-demand people, in this class particularly, we will often be looking at slides, and I will say, what do you see in the slide? Do you see that right there? And guess what the people who are in on-demand are wondering? What the heck are they looking at? So with this, hopefully I can highlight things and mark them and people can see it on the slide. We'll see if it's distracting or not. We'll just see how it goes. To introduce what we're doing in this class, though, let me get to where the course actually starts, course goal. Okay. Let me help you decide if you're in the right class or not. If you came to this class because you want to learn how to run your IDS, how to, you know, look at the alerts that are in your IDS and run trouble tickets, you're in the wrong class. That is not what this class is. That is akin to what Judy has here. Now, Judy Novak, she's actually the author of this class and wrote all the labs and everything else. Andrew contributed to some of the labs there. She put this illustration in here, and I agree with this illustration. It's like the idiot light in your car. It's like the check engine light. So the check engine light comes on. What does that mean? By the way, this is an interactive class, so I will be asking questions. Yeah. What does the check engine light mean? Something's wrong. How serious is that? I don't know. It's only the check engine light. I mean, if it were really serious, there'd be like three or four lights on, right? Maybe one of them would be red or flashing. That tells me it's really bad. Maybe the car stops. But that check engine light probably means I should do something, but I don't know what it is. You then have to take the car to the mechanic who's going to hook it up to that OBD thing, and he's going to read the code off it. Or you could just hack your own and stick it in there. You could do that too. And hopefully, now, I disagree with what Judy put up here. She said down there at the bottom of the slide, she said the outcome is that when you run that tool, she said, when you run that tool, the outcome, it reveals a code that indicates the true cause. Anyone like to work on cars? I like to work on cars. Is that statement true? Oh, no. No. That's just where you start. This is like out of The Mummy, death is only the beginning. This is just where you start in troubleshooting this problem. If that trouble code does not tell you what's actually wrong, what do you need to diagnose this problem? You need an actual mechanic, right? If all you want to do is be able to run your IDS and look at the alert and open a trouble ticket, you just need to go to some vendor supply training and read the manual for the thing. That is not what this class is. What we need to be able to do is be able to offer some expert opinion to the organization. And not only that. So here we've got this. You've got some alerts that show up. Is this a real event? Is it interesting? Is it critical? How should I respond to it? What does it mean? Does it tell me anything about the person who's attacking me? Now let's think about that for just a second. Do you think there would be any value in being able to look at the attacks that are happening against your network right now? And I'm assuming that if you're in this class, you're already doing network monitoring. Is that fair? All right, so you're seeing alerts, right? You're only seeing like 3 or 4 alerts a day, though, right? No way. You're getting thousands of alerts a day, right? Would there be any value in being able to look at those alerts and decide for yourself, you know what, I think this one's more important, not because of what the activity is, but because of what I can tell about the attacker who's launching the attack? Let me qualify that. Let's look at some of this here. Being able to diagnose things, actually look into it. So if we had some stuff coming back at us, our alerts are coming out here out of a source fire or out of a snort system. It says, hey, there's an NMAP scan, there's some kind of tunnel, there's some kind of ping sweep. What things do I actually care about? Now, before I go any further, I just want to point out to you, you'll find that in the book, all over the place, you've got these little stars with a PCAP in there. Occasionally in the class, I will actually open that up and we're going to dig into it. What that's showing you is that for every slide where we've got some packets up there, if you want to go look at these packets for yourself, they're all there in the VM, in the demo PCAPs is where you'll find those things. And all the names line up with what you got there on the slide. But we see this, and we're getting some alerts coming back. This is the check engine light. NMAP scan. Is it really NMAP? ICMP tunnel. That sounds really serious, doesn't it? ICMP tunnel. What do you think tunnel means? It's okay. You're not supposed to know all these things. Tunnel. What does it sound like that means? Someone's tunneling. What? That sounds like it could be exfiltration. That sounds pretty serious. ICMP ping sweep. That doesn't sound particularly interesting. Okay. But this is just a check engine light. What happens when we do look underneath and start looking at these things? Now, there's a question here. Who's the attacker? Who's the target? Any signs? These are the common questions that we would ask to diagnose and troubleshoot what's going on. And in looking at the output here, which I know we haven't covered in depth, but we are going to cover this in great depth over the next couple of days, we can see we've got a host out there, 92.242.140.21, and it's sending packets into 11.1.2.3.4.5.6. It's a ping sweep. It's scanning a network. All that my check engine light told me was there's a ping sweep happening, but now I've got a lot more details on this. Now, we don't have the timestamps on this. They're turned off on this particular output. But could I also look at that to determine how fast is this? How intense is this? Is this someone who's really scanning us quickly, or is this a very slow scan? Because if they're just scanning us, say, one packet at a time, that sounds like they're just running a standard kind of scan. But if they're scanning me one packet every hour, would that attacker be more interesting to you? An attacker who is scanning your network one packet an hour, would that be more interesting? Be more interesting to me. Why would that be more interesting? He's trying to evade detection. In fact, if he was scanning one host an hour, SourceFire would never have lit him up as being a scan of my network, right? My check engine light never would have gone on. But that guy's a lot more interesting. I don't know how fast these are. There's some other questions here. Now, I'm going to go a little beyond what's on the slide. Because you know what? I think there's some signs that these were crafted packets. And this is part of what we want you to be able to do. We are trying to teach you to be analysts so you can look critically at network data. Why do I say that? Because I know about the behavior of ICMP traffic. And I'm looking at the ID numbers and the sequence numbers. And I'm saying that's a little bit unusual that all those IDs and sequence numbers would be exactly the same for ICMP ping traffic. That is a little odd. That's interesting. I might want to go further and say, can I find a tool that produces a pattern that looks like that? Because if I can, and I know the vintage of the tool, it tells me a little bit about the attacker. But if I can't, if I see a pattern that I cannot find a tool that produces that pattern, tool or piece of software, that's even more interesting to me, because who probably wrote that tool? The guy who's running it against me now. This is a lot more than the check engine light, right? Now, inside of these packets, it turns out that there is a lot more interesting stuff there, too. A little more behavior. we're going to be satisfied not just with what did the log say, not just what did the high-level packets look like, but we really care about what's in the packets. So we are going to be down in the hexadecimal with these packets every day. In this particular case, we've also asked it to produce the ASCII output. And in producing the ASCII output, you might notice that we've got this stuff over here. Now, we start off with a bunch of dots, and then it turns into exclamation, double quote, pound, blah, blah, blah. If, in fact, you looked at the hex of this, you'd find that these are just incrementing hexadecimal values. And then we're finding our way up here into printable ASCII characters. That's an interesting pattern. In this case, it's a pattern that tells me that looks like it's just the plain off-the-shelf ping tool used on Unix machines, because those tools will embed that payload into the packet. But if I saw a different payload there, that would again tell me something about the attacker. There's a lot more to this than there was just a ping sweep. Looking at the syn scan, there's something that jumps out to me as being a little bit unusual. In this case, we see, well, it's apparently a local attacker who's doing it, because we can see it's all 11.62, 11.46. Might be important. I can see other things like the port numbers are staying the same, so that's a sign that they're spoofed packets. And this does look like an nmap scan based on the ports that are getting scanned. But I think it's kind of interesting over here that two of those packets have a different window size. Now, you might be listening to some of that and saying, a different what? I don't know what a window size is. Don't worry about that right now. We're going to cover that. Right now, I'm just talking to you about why it is that we are going to take the approach that we do. Let's look at this a different way. Let's take a look at the ICMP traffic, the stuff that said it was tunneling. Now, here is a real behavior that's easy to detect. If you ping something, what are you trying to do? You're trying to get a response. You want to see if it's up, right? So if you send one ping packet, what do you get back? What? Yeah, how many? Yeah, one. What are we getting here? We're getting what? That doesn't line up. So one echo request is getting two responses. That's strange. Now, why is it that my check engine light went on here? Is it because I had more than one response for one request? Was it because something in the payload of that? Was there? We don't know the answer to that yet. We're going to investigate that as we go through the week. But there's a behavior we can look at. In this particular case, in this specific case, I believe that the rule that's firing on this is lighting it up because it's actually seeing a particular fingerprint in the packet. It's not reacting to, well, there was one request and two replies. Which for me and you were like, well, that's obviously not real ICMP ping traffic. And if we look inside it, what do we find inside of that ICMP ping traffic? What does that look like? It looks like key exchange for OpenSSH. Well, that's tunneling. The point is, you need the packets. We are very interested in the packets in this class. So I'm going to warn you now that today and tomorrow are challenging days. Now, how challenging it is for you just depends on your background and experience. There are parts of it that you're just going to cruise through, and then there'll be other parts that maybe are a little bit new. And we are going to go into great depth as to how TCP/IP works. I am sure that you have a lot of knowledge and experience in this area, but what we're really interested in is how does it really work? How does it really behave? Not just what does the documentation say, but what do hosts actually do? That's what allows us to be an expert diagnostician. That's what allows us, and this is the real focus of the class, that's what allows us to say, all right, so I've got my IDS that I bought, or it's a blade, or it's whatever it is, and I've got new signatures on it, it's all configured, it's ready to go. But now that that's happening, and now that I've limited the false positives that we get out of our network, now I'm sitting here thinking, I think there's some good threat hunting that I could be involved in. What would it look like if someone were doing something bad to us, based on what we have? Do I have information people would want to steal? What protocols do we use? How does that normally look? And what would it look like if someone were doing something bad? What would be a behavior to look for? And then designing things to find those. Now, am I talking about now finding a zero day? Is that what I'm talking about? Or am I talking about finding something that zero day hasn't even happened yet? This is an activity, perhaps a malicious activity, a threat that already exists that no one knows about. and we're detecting that malicious activity on our network. Is that useful? That's why we're going to the depth that we are. Do any of you have parts of your company that produce in-house software and applications, things that you use inside the business? Do you occasionally find issues in that software? Would it be really useful for you to be able to write signatures or analysis tools to detect behaviors that are out of line for your application inside your business? When will those rules show up in the bleeding edge snort rules? Not ever. So this class is for analysts. And that is what we are trying to do over the next couple of days. So as we go through this and you say to yourself, why are we looking at packets? That's why we're doing it. And trust me, by the afternoon of the second day, usually, maybe by the morning of the third day, when we start throwing up packet captures here, even though there's sniffer output telling you what that packet does, you are going to hit a point where you're not even looking at what the sniffer says. You are just looking at the hexadecimal yourself. And there's real value in that. We should use tools. I love tools. Tools are great. But you know, sometimes your tools lie to you. You know what Wireshark is, right? Run Wireshark before? Yeah, it's a good tool. We're going to use Wireshark a lot. When Wireshark decodes a packet for you, how does Wireshark decide how to decode that packet? Oh, yeah, yeah. How does Wireshark decode packets? Not a trick question. How does Wireshark decode packets? Header information. How does it know what those headers are supposed to say? Standards, RFCs. So the RFC says in this spot there's supposed to be an NF value can be from here to here, and what happens when it's the value that doesn't match that? What does Wireshark do? Will it throw up a flag and say, hey, oh, there's a weird anomaly here? It might. Or might it try to process it and interpret it and get it wrong? Oh, yeah, it might. In fact, in the labs, I'm glad I'm having this conversation with you because I would have forgotten otherwise. Because in the labs, you're going to notice that in our virtual machine, we are using an older version of Wireshark. Now, before you fill out evaluations, I want to be super clear with you. We did that absolutely 100% on purpose. 100%. Because if you take the newest version of Wireshark, and you try to analyze some of the packet captures we've got in the class, guess what? It does not interpret the fields properly. Well, they're going through 2.0 rev, and sometimes when you move to a new version, you lose some functionality, and right, that happens. But in this class, that matters for us. We need to see what it actually says. So we're using a slightly older version. So be aware of that. I'm sure that'll get cleared up in the 2.0 line eventually. But you can't always trust your tool. You should know what it says yourself. So you're going to find yourself looking at that hex yourself. To look at that hex then, we need to talk about, starting from the basics, how does the communications model work? What does the data look like? So bear with me. We'll do this quickly because I expect most of you absolutely know this stuff really, really well. You are aware that we are using the model called TCP/IP to communicate, right? You heard of that before? You're aware that there's this other thing called the OSI model that you are required to memorize, or all those certifications you took that really doesn't matter because we don't actually use it. But we do use it. What do we use it for? What is Open Systems Interconnect used for? We do not implement it. What do we use it for? That is exactly what we use it for. We simply use it to describe network devices at sort of a meta level. That's it. We do not implement OSI for protocols. TCP/IP, though, that is something we actually use. And the TCP/IP layers do not line up well with the OSI layers, primarily because TCP/IP was implemented and adopted as a standard about 10 years before OSI was adopted as a standard. So OSI was on nobody's mind when this thing was put together. It does break things into a number of different layers, and those layers, when we're using it to transmit things across the network, just like any other network protocol, is going to encapsulate the data. So that means if you've got an application that's got some data payload up here, when that payload gets passed down into the transport layer, so for us that would be TCP or UDP, when it gets passed down onto there, that transport layer is going to tack a header onto the thing. We'll go through all those headers, but say we're just going to stick port numbers on it for now. And then it's going to hand that down to the network layer. The network access layer is the thing, or I'm sorry, let me not put the word access on that. The network layer, or internetwork layer, is the thing that's going to deal with hop-by-hop delivery. So it gets passed down again, and now it's throwing on IP addresses. And then, IP addresses are great, but that's not how computers address each other. Instead, they'd use media access controller addresses. So we again have another header we throw on there, a frame header, or an Ethernet header for the vast majority of data that we deal with. And that encapsulates data. From the point of view of Ethernet down here, this, in fact, not just this, but this entire thing is data. Just data. It does not really know what's inside it. It's true, there are markers in there, so it knows how to interpret what's next, but it's just data. That's all encapsulation does. When we look at it inside of a sniffer like Wireshark, it does a nice job of pulling out things in terms of layers. As long as we're talking about this, you likely know this, but let's just make sure. What's the difference between a packet and a frame? This is not an argument I really like myself, but it's good to know the right answer to that because there are people who want to have big, long fights about that. So packet and a frame. What's that? Frame while it's on the wire. That is a good definition. But we're going to say that the frame is connected to one of the layers. That's not wrong. But what does the packet have around it while it is on the wire? It has a link layer header on it. So when you're looking at things that still have a link layer header on them, an Ethernet, we wouldn't call it an Ethernet packet. It's an Ethernet frame. That's where the word frame is used. Personally, I don't care. I really don't care what we say in this class. It does not matter to me. Just be aware there are absolutely people who are going to all bend out of shape if you call something that has Ethernet on it a packet. It's a frame, whatever. And then when we move up from that, now we've got packets. Did we find a day one book? Oh, okay. All right. You could say that. So could we say, using OSI, could we say frames are at layer 2, packets are layer 3 and above? Yes, we could say that. That would be true. All right, fantastic. So this does a breakdown for us. Again, we'll look at that more. And as you likely know, you can twist those open and see what's inside of each of the layers, a full decode of those things. And additionally, if you were to click on one of these fields inside of Wireshark, it will then show you down in the hexadecimal output at the bottom, it will highlight for you exactly what it is that you've clicked on. We have a lot of labs we're going to do this with. This is just an overview for right now. In the top here, we're collecting or clicked on the frame, so we're getting everything. And then we're progressively clicking on different things. So now we're just clicking on the Ethernet header, then we're just clicking on the IP header, and it just highlights that. If we were to break open the IP header and we were to click on just, say, the version and header length, then it would just highlight that 4.5, the first thing that's highlighted on the slide. So it lets you see, here's how you've decoded it, where did you get that from? When packets arrive, though, at the other end, they then have to be decapsulated. Now, there are two correct words here. I'm going to mention them both because you'll find them both used in the RFCs. One of them Judy has on the slide here, de-encapsulation. That is perfectly correct. It means we're stripping the headers off and interpreting the data. But the other word you will find in the RFCs, if you're looking for something dealing with this, is decapsulation. Encapsulation, decapsulation. So you may find it without the EN as well. If you're searching for it, know that it's spelled in two different ways, okay? Just peeling the headers off and getting the data back out. Think about this, though. If you're the guy who sent the packet, you know what's in it. What if you are the person who is receiving the packet? You're going to need some information to be able to pull this all apart. There's going to have to be some standardized rules for communication, things that we call protocols. Because if you don't follow those rules or don't know where to look, how can you possibly figure out where the data is? And there's a couple of different ways that this happens. It's all defined through standards, but in those standards, as we define them for protocols, it could be that we've got something that's just a standard fixed length and it never changes size. An example of that, the Ethernet header. The Ethernet framing header is 14 bytes long. That's it. That is how big it always is. It does not change size. Asterisk, VLAN tagging looks weird. So we'll talk about VLAN tagging later. But Ethernet headers, that's it. One size. IPv6 headers, one size. They do not change size. That's it. IPv4 headers, oh no, they are flexible in size. They have a minimum size, 20, but they can be a little larger than that. And the same is true of TCP. They can be larger than that. UDP, one size, 8 bytes, that's it. So it could be either one. It could be a standard fixed length. It could be a variable length based on factors within the packet, or there's a lot of different things it could be. It could even be something that we derive based on other things that are happening in the packet. All of which means calculation and overhead. And as we talk about calculation and overhead, certainly that has an impact on receiving packets, right? And how quickly we can process them. But I want you to start thinking about that also from the point of view of, I'm trying to collect and analyze and interpret all of the data passing over the link so that I can do intrusion detection on that too. Just to add to the overhead that's involved. So these protocols add overhead. What does that look like on the wire? Well, again, if we took a look at Ethernet, inside of Ethernet, the last 2 bytes of the Ethernet header actually could be 2 different things. The kind of Ethernet we use today is using an Ethernet 2 header. That is the primary kind that you'll find, and that's been around for a long time. In an Ethernet 2 header, the last 2 bytes of the header are showing you the ether type. But it could also be something else. The older standard for this is that the last 2 bytes tell you the length of the Ethernet frame. That's interesting. So the frame itself, the header itself is only one size, but then the next value either tells you what's inside it or tells you how long the thing inside of it is. That's interesting. Those two things can coexist at exactly the same time. And in fact, I want to take this opportunity to introduce another thing, another reason we're concerned about how do these things really work under the hood. So if the Ethernet size is 1,500 bytes or less, then those 2 bytes could be used to indicate the size of the frame. In fact, if it is a number 1,500 bytes or less, it is indicating the size of the frame. If it is a value larger than 1,536, which would be hex 600, if it's larger than that, it is an Ethernet type. What if the value is 1,504? If it was 1,500 or less, it would be what length? It would be size. If it's greater than 1,536, it would be type, like this is IP, this is ARP, this is... What if it's 1,504? Now, if you're shrugging and saying, I don't know, well, that's a good answer. Because that would be what's called undefined. Undefined situations, things that RFCs don't comment on, are some of the most interesting conditions to find on networks. And will there be people who are poking around in those undefined regions? Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to say you're going to find them in the Ethernet doing that, but you will find weird Ethernet things. I'll throw one up here a little bit later to show you. In any event, we have a type perhaps that's showing us what kind of packet is inside it. And that's what we expect to find today, Ethernet 2 framing. Inside of that, it says it's IP version 4. So next we've got, oh, hey, I'm an IP packet. And inside of me, there's an offset with a byte that tells it what's inside of that. Inside of me, there's going to be TCP. And it now knows, okay, so the header's going to be about this big. And inside of those headers, now we've got some more derived fields for variable length things. In the IP header, there's a field that tells it how long the whole IP header is, because there can be options on it. And in addition to having the total length of the packet, we then have inside of the TCP header how long the TCP header is, because that can have options on it, and where the data offset actually begins. All of these layers work together. All of these fields work together to help us interpret the packets. A useful thing to bear in mind is that the layers generally do not talk to each other. There is no real glue logic between them. There are protocols that do translations between them, and certainly there is logic within the network stack that will encapsulate and decapsulate things, put things in the right place, but there is no real communication between these things. That can lead to some other very interesting edge conditions that we'll see as we go through the week too. Before we dig more, though, into these packets, let's do this hopefully really easy section on hex, bits, bytes, nibbles, and all that stuff. A bit is, what's a bit? You're not answering because it's too basic, right? What is it? It's binary. Yeah, we use it in binary. It's a 0 or a 1. It's one little switch. It's the smallest thing you can have. Okay, very good. 4 bits together is called a nibble, which is a cute name because a nibble is like a small bite, right? Yeah, so if you have a cookie, you could eat it in one bite or just take a nibble out of it, right? So 4 bits is a nibble, 8 bits is a bite. You guys know all that stuff. Why are nibbles important, though? Well, the reason for that comes down to the translation between hexadecimal and binary. It turns out that nibbles are incredibly valuable for us. We are actually kind of fortunate in a sense. We're fortunate because we ended up in a hexadecimal world. And we were for a long time headed toward an octal world. And I'll tell you, an octal world is not a place you want to be. A hexadecimal world, though, wow, there's a lot of really cool things that come out because we're using hexadecimal. Of course, the computer, but have you ever tried to read one? How much fun was that? They can be very, very challenging to read, can't they? And the way they use words can be really interesting, too. And there's other challenges that come into play. So not only are they hard to read, which even from that, we could say, maybe that explains why different things that claim to use the same protocol behave differently. Because the standard is hard to read. Maybe that's it. But it could also be that there are things that they simply didn't talk about. We're going to talk about TCP. Not now. Later. But even right now, there's things I'm sure you know. If I want to start a TCP connection, I send a what? I send a SYN. Yeah, I send a SYN. And if the host on the other end, if it wants to talk to me, it sends a SYNAP. All right, excellent. If we're having a conversation and I send you a FIN, what does that mean? We're done. Okay, excellent. What if I sent you, we are not in a connection, and I send you an ACK packet? Out of nowhere, I just send you an ACK packet. What do you think? We're not in a connection. I've never spoken to you before. I just send you an ACK. Is there a bit that kind of handles that stuff? There's a bit in there called reset, right? What's that for? Well, not for resending, but for error conditions. It's like, no, that doesn't make sense. No, you can't do that. That's illegal. Stop the connection. So if I just sent you an ACK out of nowhere, you're going to send me a reset. You're going to shut me down. If I just send you a FIN, out of nowhere, we are not engaged in a conversation, I send you a FIN, what do you think he'll send me? Reset. It's not a trick question. Here's the trick question. What if I send you a SYN and a FIN at the same time? Now, Brian here says, what? You what? That doesn't make any sense. You're saying you want to start and you want to stop at the same time? I agree with you, Brian. Now, amazingly, there actually is an RFC that someone wrote some years ago that was never adopted. Don't be fooled by this one. That is a sort of this high-speed TCP/IP communication where you can do the entire communication in 2 packets. It's going to be a SYN, FIN, ACK, push with the other side. It's got a, no one ever implemented it. It was insane. So a normal TCP/IP, SYN, FIN, that should never ever happen. And it feels like you should say reset. Now, that behavior was only adopted recently in network time, recently. It's been a few years now, but prior to just a few years ago, every operating system would have answered you SYNAC. Now, when do you send a SYNAC? You already know that. That's when someone sends me a SYN. Why would you ever answer a SYN FIN with a SYNAC? That makes absolutely no sense. It's because the RFC does not tell you how to respond to a SYN FIN. Why doesn't it tell you that? Because SYN FIN is undefined in the standard. It is not part of the communication. What happens when we bend the rules? What happens when we do things the RFC doesn't comment on? What's that? Unknown result. Yeah, unexpected. Really interesting for us and for attackers. And this one's super good because you're not supposed to copy anyone else's work, right? You know that, right? So like you're taking a test or you're doing your homework. You're not supposed to copy someone else's homework, right? So if you're in a programming class in college, you're not supposed to borrow your friend's assignment and just type that in, right? That would be bad. What if someone wrote code and like published it and sold it? Is it cool for you to just take that and put it in your stuff? Is that all right? Well, if you had a license, that would be okay. Here's the amazing thing. It seems so strange that pretty much everyone's implementation of TCP/IP responded to a SYNFIN with a SYNACK. That's really curious. What does that sort of indicate? There's a lot of borrowing going on. Because you know what? Writing network protocol stacks is difficult. And there was certainly some licensing, but there were a number of things that were not licensed that had exactly the same behavior. There's a lot of borrowing. May not cover a particular aspect. Or could simply be ignored. You know who's notorious for that? I'll bet you know. They love, we embrace standards. We embrace standards. We love standards. And then, we extend them. Who am I talking about? Microsoft, yeah. We love standards. And then we extend them, so they're no longer standard. Which means we're ignoring the RFC. Inside of the language of these RFCs, this is another thing that makes it challenging to here's what the words are supposed to mean, but yeah, it's all wishy-washy what people actually do. If the thing works, people will generally accept it, but this explains why things behave differently. Okay. We're going to take a short lab break. And in this lab break, this is not a difficult lab at all. The lab, if you've got your workbook there, take a look there. The first lab you've got, it actually begins, it opens up with some information about the VM and the passwords for the VM. And the real purpose of this lab is just to make sure everyone's got their VM working. You're going to run a couple of commands. There's nothing super earth-shattering you're going to find here. But if you run into any trouble at all, please call me over or call over Andrew and we will get you sorted out. In the book, this lab is different from all the others. Pretty much every other lab in the workbook has two approaches to it. One approach is going to be kind of I'm not really sure, I'm kind of tracking with class, but I need a little more help. And it's going to be the first approach that's going to be very directed. And then there will be a second approach that's much less directed. It will say, there was some activity, go find it. And you're off on your own. It's finding the same thing, but it's not as guided. This lab does not have that. This lab is completely directed. And the rest of the week, up through day 3, I will generally do the approach 2 on the screen after you guys do the lab. This one I'm probably not going to do on the screen, and I think you'll see why when you sit down and do it, okay? So go ahead, get yourself started. Any questions, any problems, call me over. And it is currently 10 a.m. Let's shoot for 10:15. We'll see how things are going then. If at 10:15 we're all set, we'll probably do a little bit more before break. If we need more time, we'll take more time. Any problems or questions right now? Exercise 1 in the big book, yes. Exercise 1 in the big book. You do need to bring that VM over onto your PC. Yeah, you sure do want to do that. If you did not already install VMware Player, I think you got an email ahead of class, talked about that, right? If you don't already have that, you're going to want to do it. You may find that this VM will work in VirtualBox. It's a question we always get. I believe it does work there. Do you know that, Andrew? Does it work there?
I tested it. It does work.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you have any VM problems at all, that's the guy who built it. So he can help you out. All right. Now, you are absolutely 100% welcome to ignore me and keep doing what you're doing. I wasn't going to do it, but I think I'm just going to work through this lab up here on the front screen. Okay? So you can do that with me if you want to do your own thing. That's fine, too. Just see how this all worked. And I hope that You know, there may have been some discomfort, but I just hope that's, you know, lack of familiarity, maybe haven't run this tool before, and let's see how hard this is. So the first thing, I've got my VM up and running, I'm logged in here, I opened up a terminal. For those of you who've got Surface Pros or other tablets, you may want to spend some time under the Edit menu for Preferences and under Appearance to change your font size, because otherwise it's going to be incredibly small on that screen for the whole week. You can make that change there. I've opened up a command prompt. My first challenge, run tcpdump-r against the file called concepts. Oh, well, I have to be in the right directory, don't I? So let's see, where am I now? I bet I have to be in the exercises directory, and probably for day one. -r concepts.pcap, and phew, there it goes. Now, there's already something a little bit different than what the book says. That's okay. I'm going to explain it to you. I ran it. I get the packets. That's all I had to do. How many records are displayed? Well, I could count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You could also make use of some Unix wizardry. You could say, let's see, concepts. And I'm going to pipe that output through another command. The command I'll use is word count. Word count will show you the number of characters, the number of letters, the number, or -l. I want the number of lines, and it says, hey, there's 6. Note that in this specific case, this line here was displayed in both cases. See that? It was displayed up here, too. The other lines were not displayed. It just counted them. Because word count is going to count the number of lines that appear on standard output. And that other message about reading file from concepts, now, I'm not saying that an error happened, but that's being printed on standard error. So it's just not visible. It just doesn't count it. All right, so there's 6 lines. Number 2. Now, here's where there's a little discrepancy. It says, you noticed it took some time to receive that TCP dump output, right? Right? That took some time, right? No. No, it was fine. We made a change in the VM this time. Prior to this run of the class, the VM had no connection out of your computer. If your computer is not currently connected to the Wi-Fi, then yours is going to run real slow when you do that TCP dump. But if you are connected to the Wi-Fi, it'll be fine. The reason why it might be slow is that it's currently doing a DNS resolution for each one of those numbers. Now, in this case, it still showed up as numbers, 192.168. Because 192.168, what is that? What? Yeah, non-route, not. It's the use for private stuff. So am I going to have a DNS resolution on that? No, not unless you add records for it, you're not. So that's why I don't see anything. I'd suggest to you that you get in the habit when you're using Wireshark, when you're using TCPDump, or any other tool to analyze packets for intrusion detection and prevention, get in the habit of turning off name resolution. There's 2 reasons why. Number 1, it's slower. Number 2, so there's an attacker. There's an attacker. Hold on, I need more desk space here. Wait a minute. Here we are. We're on this side over here. Is that on the screen? Yeah, okay. We're on this side over here. We're happy little Bob. So you're going to see Bob a lot this week. So we're Bob. We're over here. We're on the network. And there's things happening. Bob is the analyst. And he's watching activity against the computer over here. And off on the internet, there's another guy. He is another guy you will see a lot this week. He is our friend Eddie. Evil Eddie is up to no good, as always. And Evil Eddie is going to attack Bob's network. When Eddie attacks Bob's network, if Eddie is smart, not only will he send his attack packets. So let's say my red seems to have gone missing, so we'll go with fluorescent purple. So he sends in his attack against this box, and Bob is monitoring that. So Bob sees that. He observes that. And now Bob wants to investigate. If Eddie is smart, Eddie is running something on his end, or at the very least, monitoring some things on his end. Because now when Bob is doing this analysis, if he does a DNS lookup, where does that go? So does Eddie potentially have a name server that he owns? Or at least can watch the logs for? And if we send, or Bob sends a DNS query back to find out, well, who is that who's talking to me? Is that an observable event potentially for Eddie? Why don't we want to send back DNS lookups? You've just told him that you're looking at him. Now, this is a cat and mouse game, okay? Because you might say, well, wait a minute. No, I do want to send the DNS lookup then because what's my hope? I'll deter him because he knows I'm watching. I send an attack in. You send a DNS request 5 minutes later. I send a different attack. You send a DNS request 5 minutes later. I send another attack. You do not send a DNS request. I send another attack. You send a DNS request 5 minutes later. What do I know? I know what you can't detect, don't I? There are a lot of reasons this is a bad idea. Can I tell what hours the analyst works? Can I tell all kinds of things? And can I tell, oh, look at that. The DNS resolution request did not come from the company I'm attacking. It came from Dedel SecureWorks, their managed solutions provider. So I know who's doing your monitoring. Does that all make sense? Okay. So we probably do not want to send those back. It's an efficiency thing, but it's also you're revealing information about yourself. Back to the lab here. Where was I? Number two. So we're going to run that again, and the better way to run that is with a dash N. So the dash N is going to turn off the name resolution. We're going to suggest you do that regularly. The third question. It said run TCP dump and read the first two records of the input file. Concepts.pcap. This is done using the dash C2 option. Now, if you'd like a little more information on the options that are available, I would again direct you to your handy quick reference guide, because it turns out that there is a section on that that is all about TCP dump usage. So in this particular lab, we're telling you what the option is, but we're just going to assume that you know how to look at the quick reference, because right here it tells you what the options are. There are more options than this. There are other things you can get it to do. But these are the main options that you're going to find yourself using. Back to our question then. I want to run TCP dump dash C2. So let's write TCP dump dash R concepts dash C2. And I'm going to throw in the dash N just out of good habit. And is there anything else here? There's another dash T. Well, I'll just start with that. And then it's saying one here. You can also use the dash T to suppress the display of the timestamp. Yeah, you could do that if you want to. And that just makes the timestamp go away. There are other things you can do with the timestamp. You know, adding two T's is going to change you to a raw second or a raw epoch timestamp. Three T's, you're going to get it as a offset from the time the packet capture started. Four T's, you're going to get it as a full timestamp. So there's a lot of dash T things that you can do with it. What command did you use? Okay, we did that. What is the source IP number in the second record displayed? Well, I think that would be 192.168.11.13. Does that seem right? Okay, that seems right to me. Also in the workbook, after each set of exercises, are all of the answers and a walkthrough for each one of them. So I think we got that one. Number four, run TCP dump. Clear my screen here. Run TCP dump. Read in the concepts file to display a record in, what's this one? Use the dash X. Oh, okay. So we're just adding the dash X option. You still must use one last reminder. Continue to. Okay. Is it, am I reading it too quickly? Is it asking for anything more? Whoops. Oh, it wanted the first record. So I did not read it carefully enough. Thank you. C1. And there we have the first record. There it is. What command did you use? There it is. I used that command right there. Excellent. What are the first two bytes that you see in the hex dump of the first record? Now, this one can be a little tricky for you if you haven't looked at hex in a while. So the numbers to the left here, Those columns of numbers on the left, that is just showing you offsets within the packet. That is not part of the packet. It's just informational. It's a roadmap. Everything to the right over here, going the other way, the 450, those are the bytes. We said that every hexadecimal digit can be represented by a nibble. A nibble is 4 bits. So 2 hexadecimal digits together, that would be 1 byte. So 4-5, that would be 1 byte. 0-0, that would be the second byte. So I believe that the first 2 bytes are 4-5-0-0. Remember that one, okay. And then it has another question. It says, what is the IP protocol field value? Excellent, it is 0-1. Let's take a look at the quick reference and find this. And I'm going to get you used to counting. I know you know how to count. But counting things in computers. When we count things in computers, we don't ever start with 1, except in some weird programming languages. We instead start at 0. So we start at a 0 offset. So this here, this would be offset 0, the version in IHL, they're together. Then that's offset 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So the protocol is at offset 9. Note, you do not count these rows. What are these rows for? What are they trying to show you? You don't count those. You do count, I'll put it in a different color, I'll put them in green. You do count these rows. You don't count the boxes here that have nothing in them. You don't count those boxes. What are those boxes doing? Yeah, it's just trying to show you. Here's where the nibbles are. That's what it's trying to show you. I told you earlier, I personally do not like the changes that they've added to make this thing better because there's now so many things on it that don't do anything. People get confused. They're counting the wrong boxes. So we're only counting the lines that actually have stuff in them. That brought us off to offset 9. That is going to be a very familiar number. We're going to spend a lot of time there. Because offset 9, that's how we find the embedded protocol header. It's calling it here the IP protocol header. In our case, someone said 0-1. Let's see how we got there. So 4-5 is 0 offset. 0-0 is the next. 0-0 is another one. 5-4 is the next one. 0-1-2-3-4-5-6-7-8-9 takes us to the 0-1. Can you see how we got that? All right. Outstanding. It then asks us about some other values around it. What is the time to live value? Well, if I look at my quick reference, I note that the TTL is actually just to the left of the protocol. So that would just be the other side of this. It would be the 4-0. That would be the time to live. Good? Value converted into, yeah, I'm not doing that. Sorry, Judy. I could just multiply 4 times 16. Where is that right? Yeah, 4 times 16. 64. Does that sound good? Check my math on things because I will get math questions wrong. Okay, so 64. Number 5. Sorry. There was a check your answer thing here. You could also do a dash V. Oh, look at that. When I add the dash V in there, it will add some other stuff up here. It has some protocol layer decode, like it tells me the type of service and the time to live and the ID number and a bunch of other stuff, and similarly does the same thing at the ICMP layer. And you can add more Vs to get it to do more things. Say that again? Yeah, it calculates it out. It pulls it out to the calculated value. Next question. Run TCP dump and display the MAC or Ethernet address in the first record. Okay. TCP dump, dash R, concepts, dash N, dash E. So looking at my quick reference chart, dash E is going to give me link layer header information. And I want the first packet, so I could do that. Now, there's another way to see that stuff. I could also do, actually, I'll leave that there. Let me do a dash XX. When I do the dash XX, something happens. I want you to notice over here. See that 4500? See that sitting on the end of that line? 4500 is going to be your best friend. You're looking at hexadecimal stuff that starts with 4500. Guess what you're looking at? That is the start of an IP header. I am sorry, that is the start of an IP header. Could it be a 4.6 or a 4.7? Or it could be, but you know what? 4.5? That is going to be your best friend. You see it all the time. Note that I do not have that sitting over here. Well, that's the IP header sitting over here. So what must this stuff be? The what? It is the Ethernet header. It is the frame header. And I just want to draw your attention to an interesting fact, and again, why I want to know what the packet actually looks like, okay? It tells me up in the TCP dump output, well, the source was AA0004, the destination was 000C29. Source, destination. Take a look at that packet. TCP dump is correctly pulling that apart. What comes first, the source or the destination? If you're looking up here, the source comes first. But if you look in the packet, what comes first? Destination comes first. 000C29, that's the destination. See that? And then the source. This, again, was for efficiency, is why it was designed this way for signaling. Because now I don't have to look inside the packet to find it. The MAC address where I'm supposed to send this thing, the link layer address, is always the first thing in the packet. It was an efficiency thing. The way my sniffer represents that to me is a little bit different. Know that in the packet it's represented in that way. So there's two options to finding that one, the dash E, but also the dash XX. Run TCP dump, blah, blah, blah. Use the options to suppress name resolution, examine the final record. Okay, this is getting to be too long for me. TCP dump concepts dash N. What am I doing? Use the suppress name and timestamp resolution. What is the protocol name that follows proto in the output of the header line? Use dash V. Okay. Well, I'm looking up here. It says the proto is UDP. It says it's UDP. Okay. Am I missing something magical here? Is there some deeper meaning to this, or is that the question? That seems like it's a question. Okay. All right. Easy enough. Bonus question. What is the hexadecimal value associated with that protocol? The value follows the protocol name in the first. Oh, well, we could probably figure that out. It tells me here it's going to be 17. It's the thing that follows it in parentheses. I could also convert that into hexadecimal. This is another one you will see a great deal of. You will see ICMP, which is 1. You'll see TCP that is 6, and UDP that is 17, or in hexadecimal, 1-1. Yeah. What is the application that follows the protocol layer? Well, I'm just going to take a stab at this here and say that looks a heck of a lot like DNS traffic. Sound fair? Okay. And, oh, look at that. Hey, that's the end of the exercise. Good job. If any of that is unclear or unfamiliar, then you should definitely call me or Andrew over as we get into the next lap.